This HedgeGhoul series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com.
Well, good evening, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland HedgeGhoul. And I'm your HedgeGhoul master, Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland Magazine. And this event is a spin-off from a recent supplement. I presume you're all familiar with the magazine itself. But as well as the magazine, this year we have a special supplement entitled The Global Revolution. And that in turn is a spin-off from a project co-sponsored by this university and Queen's University in Belfast. And Enda just came out there as one of the people involved. And Fergal McGarry here on my right from Queen's is the other. Now, the topic here tonight is Scotland and the Global Revolution. So to what extent did revolutionary developments abroad shape what happened within Ireland during the revolutionary period, 1919 to 23? And in what ways did events within Ireland impact beyond Irish shores? For instance, amongst the large Irish diaspora population and other national groups. So we're going to discuss this generally, but we're also going to look at the particular case of Scotland and this city. And I'm joined then by Darry Gannon. Darry's got an article in the supplement, by the way. Have to get that plug in. Fergal McGarry here, and these two lads are both Queen's University. And then on my left, Niall Whelehan of Strathclyde University, and finally Kirsty Lusk of the rival city up the road, Glasgow. Just before I start, I just want to get a thank you in. Apart from Enda and Fergal, I just want to a word of thanks to the Irish government's commemorations unit, who have flown me over here at great expense. And we'll be wining and dining the lot of us later. Just to explain the format of this evening, the HedgeGhoul, it's an informal format. I'm going to ask these people up here a few difficult questions and see how they get on. Remember, you're at school here, guys. You have to do a bit of work. Sit up straight in your seat, pay attention, and formulate a question or two or an observation. We don't just have a Q&A at the end. We encourage the audience to dive in at any time. Just put your hand up, and I will come to you. But we'll possibly let the panel warm up a little bit first. So we're open to questions at any stage, and we have a radio mic. Now, the other thing to bear in mind is this is being recorded, so keep it clean. Now, just to get started. Now, this might seem like I'm aware, for example, that this we're recording this for subsequent podcasts. So a lot of people in Ireland in particular will be listening to this. I just want to clarify something at the outset, which is Scotland's constitutional position as opposed to Ireland's, because I think a lot of people in Ireland kind of lazily think that Scotland was conquered in the same way. And of course, you weren't conquered here. Yours was a voluntary union with the people to the south. So it is different in that sense. The other thing is, I'd just like just to talk a little bit about what was the population of Scotland? I'm assuming about 5 million, am I right on that? So it's roughly the same as Ireland. Representation in Westminster, I'm assuming about 70, that'd be correct? 60, 70 seats in Westminster. And of course, Ireland had much more. Ireland had over 100. But that was because the population was dropping throughout the 19th century. So Ireland was actually overrepresented in Westminster. And my final question is then, how did that break down? So who were the main political parties here? I'm assuming the Conservative and Unionist Party, Liberals and Labour, essentially. So they're the three main parties. Now, Niall, can I just come to you first, like, because just to talk about the, you know, where all these Irish people came from that ended up in this part of the world, all over Scotland.
So, say between the Great Famine and the Irish Revolution, about 8% of the people who left Ireland came to Scotland. Of the millions of people who left Ireland in that sort of 70-year period came here. Many arrived during the famine. So in 1851, the Irish population of Scotland had increased by 90% to about 200,000 people. The peak of Irish-born people in this period in Scotland was about the 1870s, 1880s. During the kind of Land League time, there was about a quarter of a million Irish-born people in Scotland, and a massive proportion of them lived in Glasgow. So 140,000 of them lived in Glasgow and 10,000 in Edinburgh. Like, so there's a huge...
So it's very much concentrated in Glasgow.
At that time, yeah. So that was really a huge number in Glasgow. So when we get to the 1916 rising, there's less Irish-born people in Scotland, not significantly so. There's about 175,000. 50,000 of them live in Glasgow, but the overwhelming majority live in sort of Lanarkshire and Glasgow. And they're about 4% of the Scottish population. So it's decreasing, but there's still a very
vibrant Irish
community.
So immigration from Ireland is diminishing when you come into the 20th century?
From sort of the 1870s, it's decreasing every year in the census, but it's still quite large. And of course, you have this second and third generation communities that also participate in this very vibrant sort of Irish cultural and political scene.
So at a rough guess, how many, you know, what portion of the population could be described as either Irish-born or of Irish background in the early 20th century, roughly?
Well, 4% were Irish-born at the time of the 1916 rising, so of Irish background, you'd probably say maybe 10%. Some scholars have estimated it around 10%. I mean, it's very hard to put your finger on that. Maybe Enda knows, I have a clear idea, but I'd say around 10%. Of course, Irish community wasn't defined by nationalist politics, just to say, but there was, you know, quite a distinctive and significant mobilisation of Irish diaspora nationalism in Scotland going back to the Fenian movement. So the famine emigrants really engaged with the Fenian movement. And while we tend to think of Irish nationalism, the high watermark of it being during the revolutionary era, for example, in the 1860s, the Fenian movement had 8,000 recruits in it, in comparison to 2,000 or 2,500 in Scotland, IRA volunteers in Scotland during the revolutionary era. So the Fenian movement was a bigger mobilisation. They also tried to send people to Ireland in 1867. The sort of timing of the rising and the lack of notice meant that huge numbers didn't go to fight, but some did. And the IRB presence in Scotland from then, from the 1860s, continues throughout the 19th century into the 20th century, as it does in Ireland. And of course, during the revolution period, the Fenian IRB provides a bedrock for a lot of the volunteer movements in Scotland in the War of Independence.
I just want to go to Dara about the similar situation in other British cities, right? But before that, just before we forget about it, you're talking about politically they could be, you know, quite varied, right? But it was defined by religion, right? I'm assuming the bulk of these people are Catholic.
Yeah.
And would it be correct to say then that the bulk of Catholics in Scotland are people of Irish background, or is that an incorrect assumption to make?
Well, there are Scottish Catholics as well, and of course there's arguments and a lot of divisions between them in the Catholic Church. There's sort of rivalries between Irish and Scottish Catholics in the Catholic Church in the 19th century. In terms of Irish politics and Irish nationalism, the sort of Catholic-Protestant question is not so sharply defined, I would say, in the 19th century as it becomes maybe later on. So, for example, if you take the Land League, the leader of the Land League in Scotland was John Ferguson, who's a Presbyterian from Ulster, and other leaders were also Protestant. So it wasn't exclusively Catholic, even though you'd have to say the majority of people.
A bit like the early days of the Land League in Ireland. I mean, there was a lot of Presbyterian tenant farmer involvement in that. Darry, can you just go on the broader, does the Scottish situation, does that chime with what's happening in other big cities, Liverpool, Manchester, you know, other parts of the United Kingdom?
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the kind of the nationalist movement and so on from the 19th century. And actually, Scotland, of course, was one of the main core areas for the United Irish League of Great Britain and, of course, the Ancient Order of Hibernians. Our own Patrick Mannion here is very interested in the Ancient Order of Hibernians. But so there is a very strong nationalist organisation structure which goes right across the United Kingdom, but it's very focused as well on Scotland. So, you know, for example, the Home Rule movement survives, for example, the 1916 Rising much more strongly in Scotland than it does anywhere else in, let's say, Liverpool, London or Manchester.
You know, the Irish Home Rule movement.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. The United Irish League, etc. Especially the Home Government branch, and you mentioned Ferguson earlier on. This was kind of these kind of journalists who kind of were very much to the fore in kind of Glasgow Irish politics, were very much to the fore of the United Irish League movement in the late 19th, early 20th centuries. And so there is a very strong continuity there in the tour from the late 19th century, right past 1916 up until around 1919 and 1920 in Scotland specifically. And the Ancient Order of Hibernians really buttressed the kind of nationalist movement during this period, adding numbers but also financial support to, you know, from Parnell right up to John Redmond.
Okay. Now, Kirsty, can I bring you in here? Because no discussion of this sort is complete, of course, without mention of James Connolly, from, you know, born in this city. I mean, has his position just been exaggerated, or is his, you know, is his, you know, predominance in this discussion, is it justified?
I believe it is. Yeah, I think Connolly is an incredibly fascinating figure as a sort of focus for some of the complexities that come around the Irish-Scottish relationship. You know, if we think about it, at the time, 1889, Connolly is leaving the British Army. He's returning to Edinburgh. At the same time, Parnell is being given the freedom of the city of Edinburgh by the Liberal Party, and there's a great Home Rule demonstration in support of Ireland, which I think it's 300,000 turnout to meet him. But Connolly certainly is a figure that very much brings together Scotland and Ireland in different ways, particularly with the support that was coming from Ireland in 1916. It was to Seamus Reader that was taking over the munitions to Connolly and Markievicz. That was where the Glasgow-based support was going to when they were taking the munitions and weapons over.
Can I just go back a little bit, Kirsty, just to Connolly's active period in Edinburgh. When roughly was he active in Edinburgh? Like, before he even came to Ireland?
So he returned to Scotland in 1889 and was active from probably then on. And even before then, he was really learning his socialism in Edinburgh. He was born in Edinburgh, which is something that still goes overlooked in Ireland to a certain extent. And he really learned his socialism in the streets.
So he's got a fair chunk of his career already under his belt.
Yes, uh-huh.
Before he comes back to Ireland.
Definitely.
Yeah,
yes,
right.
And even in 1914, he's still writing for Forward, the Glasgow-based publications. So almost right up to the rise, and he still has links with Scotland and Glasgow.
Right. Fergal, can I bring you in here? Because in a way, this dovetails into the kind of the central concept of this global revolution thing, which is the effect of radicalisation from outside Ireland into Ireland. Maybe just talk a little bit about that, because it seems to me Connolly is a perfect example of this.
I think so. So one of the starting points for our project is that I think we tend to think about the Irish Revolution as something that happens within Ireland. And that's a kind of a perfectly understandable sort of assumption. But actually, when you start looking at individuals and organisations and the movement of people and the movement of ideas, it very rapidly becomes more complicated. So if you look at look at the Republican movement back in Ireland, it's political strategy is very much predicated on a kind of an international strategy of winning international support. Its propaganda is based towards an international audience. If we look even at the military side of what Republicans are doing in Ireland, they need guns. Those guns, some of those guns are coming from abroad. They need money to fight the war. Much of that money is coming from abroad, from America and so on. And that brings us then into, so even if we're just interested in how the revolution militarily and politically is working out in Ireland, we have to start thinking in that kind of international space. The other really important dimension is the diaspora themselves. I mean, I think about 1 in 3 Irish people, 1 in 3 living Irish people are living outside the country. And if we think about even something as straightforward as politicisation, it's really interesting how many people who are sort of household names in the Irish Revolution in Ireland have actually passed through other areas. I mean, De Valera is born in America. Michael Collins is radicalised in London. The Fenians are bankrolled and organised from America. And if we look at connections with Scotland, there's some really interesting points of interest. If we think about the Clyde side, it's industrial, working class, very strong in labour and socialism. A lot of the people who become well known in Ireland as labour leaders or socialist leaders actually come from Scotland or come from Britain. So we think about, Connolly's a specific interesting example. Think about Jim Larkin from Liverpool, Thomas Johnson from Liverpool, Michael Davitt's coming from the industrial north of England. And there's a really interesting body of thought which looks at the idea of the movement of people is not just about an idea moving from one place to another place, but actually the movement itself generates really interesting political developments. So if we think about Connolly, to the best of my knowledge, Connolly wasn't a physical force Republican and he wasn't a cultural nationalist in Scotland. It's when he comes to Ireland to take up a trade union job, I think primarily for economic reasons, that his politics change and he creates this sort of fusion of what's really a kind of a British or Scottish form of socialism with Irish republicanism and cultural nationalism. And I think you can see that at the level of lots of ordinary people in Scotland and in Ireland. So the process of movement isn't just a sort of an interesting what if, but actually I think it's quite important to figuring out how political ideas operate within the different spaces in which the revolution takes place.
Yeah, because isn't it a case that for the vast bulk of Irish people, their conditions abroad are completely different? I mean, they're by and large urban, industrial, working class, as opposed to rural,
yeah,
agricultural.
So we talk about the diaspora, and the diaspora are very important, or raising money or spugging arms or whatever, but actually the diaspora is different in every country. So the diaspora in Scotland is different to the diaspora in England, and actually the IRA do different things, partly as a result of the structure of where people are, where they're based and so on. But particularly if we look at the political context, so, for example, the Irish diaspora in Dominions tend to keep their head down a little bit because they're in sort of Anglophile, Protestant kind of countries. Catholics are a small minority. Then you look at the Irish diaspora in America, and they're much, much more assertive. And I think this plays into what Ari was talking about, which is the shift of political change from Redmondism to Republicanism. It happens much quicker in some places than others. Like, it seems to me, I think you can make a case that, say, Irish Americans, like in New York, are actually ahead of Ireland in terms of the shift from constitutional nationalism or Redmondism to Republicanism. It's happening around the beginning of the First World War period rather than 1916 or 1917. And then somewhere like England or Scotland, it's a lot slower, that shift from Redmondism to separatism. And it's partly to do with the specific context that people find themselves in within these different sort of diaspora populations.
Just I want to develop it in a second, but just to go back to you, Neil. Did you say that the sectarian element wasn't such an issue, the Catholic Protestant divide?
No, it was always an issue.
Right.
It was more of an issue in Scotland than it was in England, and probably more of an issue, at least by the late 19th century, in Scotland than it was in the United States, for example. So studies of, I guess, mobilisation of Irish nationalists in Scotland have referred to anti-Catholic prejudice, discrimination, as a sort of mobilising factor that maybe partly explains why there were more, you know, nearly three times as many Scottish people active during the Irish Revolution as there were in England, for example.
No, but just tease this one out. Was there any, we talked about kind of solidarity of the diaspora with various movements, constitution and revolutionary in Ireland. Was there a similar thing on the other side? I mean, was there a fellow feeling with, say, Ulster Unionists, which is, you know, if you go to Belfast today, you'll see they have Scottish salt here all over the place, right? Is that just a recent phenomenon? That sort of, Ranger supporting loyalist from Belfast.
You actually, even in the pre-1916 period, during the height of the Ulster crisis, you have UVF units formed in Scotland, for example.
Okay, so there
and
are.
And they're very public about that. They're sending newspaper reports into the place, like the newspapers like the Glasgow Observer, which would be widely read. So you actually almost have a competing discourse about, you know, what the union was, who benefited in the newspapers of the day. At that time, and even in the post-1916 period during the War of Independence, for example, there's considerable, like the police reports actually based here at the National Archives in Edinburgh do document the kind of tensions with local communities. There's a lot as well of, reporting of Republican activities by the local community to the police because they're believed to be, treacherous or seditious and so on.
Sorry, Chris, do you want to come in there?
Yeah, I was just going to add into that is that you then have a position where in the very streets of Glasgow you have sectarian gangs forming up on either side of that divide and sort of spilling into violence in the streets at times. And that's post-1916, you're starting to see that. And it's combined with the rise in Republican support in Glasgow.
And have they discovered football at this stage, or is that again an
April? Well, one of the... I think one of the Protestant gangs was the Billy Boys, but yes, but that stage of yes, they've discovered football as well.
Okay.
But it's sympathetic Scottish nationalists had a journal called Liberty in the 1920s where they reprinted Sinn Féin articles in it. And one of the newsagents that sold it was across the road from Ibrox, so I don't think they got a lot of pass and trade.
There was a Govan brand, a branch of the IRA, the Govan Circle that ran.
And you can also take those tensions and sort of look at them at the macro global scale, and you see very similar kind of tensions and arguments in places like New Zealand and Australia and so on. In Australia, for example, the Irish question becomes hugely important from the Easter Rising onwards, and it becomes part of the debate about whether or not there should be conscription. And you've got a very sharp alignment between conservatives who want to see conscription and an alignment between Labour and Irish nationalists. And that takes on a very sectarian kind of character, similarly in Canada. So it's not just we tend to know and think a lot about Republicans and Nationalists, but you see Orangism and Loyalism and Unionism mobilised throughout the empire, and sometimes very effectively, as in places like Canada. And all that does shape, to a certain extent, the pressures that apply on Britain as we come into the War of Independence itself and how that gets settled.
I want to just go back to the 1916 Rising, right? Obviously, Connolly is involved. Do we know, you know, how many people of Scottish background, maybe Irish, but who had lived in Scotland, you know, expats, how many were involved in 1916? My impression seems to me that Irish people from outside Ireland were disproportionately represented in that small sample.
In 1916, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the numbers seem to vary. It's suggested that maybe up to about 30 people came over from Scotland to fight in the Easter Rising. Other people say it's around 16. Most of them seem to have come from Glasgow, so it's small enough, but you also have groups of men and women. Margaret Skinner, for example, comes over from Glasgow, Liverpool, Manchester, London. So the big Irish centres of population. So they probably represent, they end up in Dublin a few months before the Rising itself. And there's sort of a garrison they're small but significant kind of number. They cause a lot of confusion on the streets of Dublin because they when they mobilise, some of them don't know where the GPO is. They're lost, they have to ask directions. Some of them go onto a Connell Street bridge, and Irish-born people are shocked to find people with Scottish and English accents with guns, you know, telling them to get off. So there's all sorts of confusion and chaos. But I think it's quite a small number, and the main importance of the IRA in Scotland, which was, it lies in other areas. But you do have, right up to the Civil War, for example, you do have small but significant numbers taking part in the fighting that's going on. During the Civil War, for example, I think you've got about 50 anti-treatyites coming over from Scotland and about 250 pro-treatyites. So they're not insignificant. And I guess one of the things which characterises the Irish...
These are people in Scotland but of Irish background.
Yeah. Or Irish-born, many of them would be Irish-born. But I was just going to say, each diaspora is characterised by different circumstances. One of the interesting things about the Scottish diaspora is its proximity to Ireland. Mm. And that's really important in terms of they can come over. And in fact, when you're looking at the IRA and how they're run in Scotland, people come over from Dublin, people come over from Belfast. So there's much more of a kind of a traffic than you would find in other places.
Can I just mention one thing? I want to just throw this in because I'm going to forget it, right? Just in the discussion before, and I asked the question, you know, was there a home rule movement in Scotland? This is pre-World War One. And Kirsty, you were saying that there was actually a home rule bill passed for Scotland.
At the same time as the home rule bill was passed for Ireland, there was one passed for Scotland as well. And it was a similar circumstance where, with the beginning of the First World War, it was delayed and then never really... returned from then on. However,
why was that scarce? Why was it forgotten about?
It wasn't necessarily forgotten. Well, there was a governmental change in the middle of the First World War. There was continued support for Scottish Home Rule. I think we start seeing Scottish Home Rule committees of 1917 onwards. Mm-hmm. But it could be argued that with the Scottish involvement in the First World War, and the events of the Easter Rising, we see a kind of decrease in support for Scottish Home Rule, and a sort of maybe bond of blood, you could almost suggest, with the events of the First World War.
It would seem to back up the argument then that, which still rages amongst Irish historians, that just because the Home Rule Bill for Ireland was passed in 1912, this does not necessarily mean it was ever going to be implemented, right? But that's a different... We have proof of it here,
It's interesting to think about the structure of politics. By the late 19th century, Ireland basically has its own political parties, which are centred around the Irish question, whereas that doesn't happen to the same extent in Scotland, whereas it had been like that in Ireland. And we're now, from getting to the present-day politics, one of the interesting stresses and strains in the present-day UK is you now have political parties which are much more organised regionally, and I think that causes a certain pulling away of the central state over time.
And that's, we do start seeing a movement towards that in the aftermath of 1916. We start seeing a movement to creating some sort of Scottish political party. We also see, I think it's John McLean that creates a Scottish branch of the Communist Party. So there is that sort of movement at that time period of a separation of sorts.
Even within actually just the nationalist or even republican movement post-1916, it's quite interesting to note that while the 19th century and early 20th century home rule movement was united across borders, you know, in Great Britain itself, as the United Irish League of Great Britain, post-1916, Sinn Féin, the Republican movement in Great Britain is divided from basically the border between Scotland and the north of England. And Scotland maintains the Sinn Féin appellation or title, whereas down south it becomes the Irish Self-Determination League. And even though it sounds, and they do kind of, you know, chime with each other in terms of wanting Irish independence, the Scottish Sinn Féin political movement, and notwithstanding the IRA, are vehemently Republican and separatist in a way that, you know, nationalists south of that border aren't, which is quite interesting going back to Fergal's point about why, you know, why be a nationalist in Scotland and what are the kind of, you know, contingent factors, whether it be living in an urban community, whether it be communal differences or tensions and so on, that make, you know, Irish people of Irish birth or of Irish descent more Republican than their counterparts south of that border.
So if you look at some of the accounts of politicisation that you have in the Bureau of Military History, you've got a handful of accounts of people who primarily come from Glasgow. And some of them, when they talk about how they're politicised, it's very like how Republicans are politicised in Belfast. Mm. They're joining flute bands, there's sectarian rioting, there's strong political and sectarian tensions. In some ways, they're growing up in a more sectarian and politicised environment than some Irish people in the south of Ireland. So there's a really distinctive set of characteristics and a much stronger influence of socialism and kind of British forms of radicalism.
Mm. Yeah, because I think after 1916, it's John Wheatley that suggests that we see a turn in the Irish diaspora in certainly Glasgow, but in Scotland, and a sort of rise of support for socialism. So Connolly's death in particular begins to turn things there.
So you're saying that Connolly's death gives an impetus to socialist ideas?
It was John Wheatley's suggestion, yes,
right,
that he found, certainly amongst Irish Catholics that he was approaching from a socialist perspective,
right,
there was an increase in support for socialism in the aftermath of 1916.
I think just one thing that might be worth commenting, because this comes up a lot in the discussion of the Irish situation, is that it was possible to be a Catholic and be a socialist until quite late into the 1920s. Like, I think it wasn't until the late 20s or even the 30s that, say, the Soviet Union takes an explicitly anti-clerical position. Because, you know, it can seem very odd when you look at it, say, you know, Countess Markovitch, this is classic, you know, Godspeed Lenin, right? I mean, it sums up that whole contradiction there, right? So that doesn't surprise me, you know, that the two aren't necessarily contradictory.
It's the same period when the Vatican takes up an explicitly anti-communist position, that idea of a crusade against communism.
That's later as well.
That's early 30s.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's after this period. Yeah.
I think it's Wheatley's exact wording is a sort of a overcoming a mountain of prejudice against socialism is what he's finding in those communities in the aftermath of 1916. And he specifically ties that into Connolly.
Just to come in maybe on that point in terms of Irish nationalists, socialists in Scotland and other places, I guess there's a broader question about sort of the communism and small nation nationalism. So the common term position after 1919 is that small nations are a bad thing and they break up larger confederations of workers. So they don't want a Scottish party, a Welsh party and an English party, they want the British Communist Party. And John McLean kind of goes against that, and he sees small nation nationalism as a way of shattering British imperialism and breaking this next stage of capitalist development, which he saw was this sort of war between England or Britain and America, and slug it out for world dominance. So I guess there's this window around the time of the Irish Revolution where small nation nationalism is compatible with socialism, maybe communism. But later in the 1920s, the common turn sort of push against that, and it becomes a little bit more difficult. So if you take someone like Willie Gallagher, who was a collaborator with Maclean in the sort of 1919-1920, he takes more of the common turn line and splits with Maclean because there's a sort of pressure on him to sort of downplay small nation nationalism, whether in Ireland or also in Scotland.
Kirsty, could you talk to me about John McLean? Because he seems to be the centre of this. I mean, how significant was he, or is he just somebody howling in the wind on the fringes?
I think very much his significance at the time gathering support, but also throughout history since his legacy has left. You know, we still get marches in Glasgow and so on and so forth, but McLean very much brings together those ideas of nationalism and socialism and the support for the working classes. Sorry, now you mean to...
He wasn't slow in giving good advice either. Like, you know, when he came to Ireland, you know, he tended to get into the trouble with, well, he get into trouble with everybody, it seems to me, right?
McLean.
I think maybe one of the most interesting things about McLean, which we don't, it's kind of hard to substantiate, that he suggested later, so he was in prison during the 1916 rising, and we don't really know exactly what he thought about it at the time. But he later suggested that through his contacts with Connolly, maybe via Seamus Reader, that Connolly's idea to rebel in 1916 was some, in part, shaped by Red Clydeside and a lot of the labour activity in Glasgow at the time, and in Scotland more broadly, and that contributed to his idea that there was time for a revolution, not just in Ireland, but there was maybe a simultaneous revolution in Scotland as well. Now, we don't know more about that, because that was Maclean's version, but it is interesting that would spin, I guess, give a new spin to Connolly's thinking in 1916.
Just for any of our Irish listeners here, what do you mean by Red Clydeside? It's one of these things that gets tossed out. What are we talking about here?
We're talking about a period from about 1910 to 1930 of industrial disputes across various industries, huge strikes, huge confrontations with police, occasionally with the army, lots of union organisation, rise in socialism, communism, so on. So I guess that's a sort of industrial unrest around Glasgow, but also more broadly in Scotland, what it refers to.
And it was very much... heightened by the industrial element of the Clyde with the First World War and the increase in working hours, the creation of munitions, the shipyards, and in turn that also offered opportunities for those that would be taking weapons to Ireland or getting access to explosives, so that industrial nature provided opportunities there.
Listen, let's tell you what, I want to just get on to the War of Independence period. Let's just focus on that, right? In terms of organisation, okay, because post-1916, when the leaders were released about a year later, they did two things. One was to rebuild Sinn Féin as a political organisation. The other was to rebuild the Irish Volunteers. And, of course, then within the Irish Volunteers, you had the IRB as a secret caucus. What were the organisations then outside Ireland? Either one of you, whoever wants to...
Well, Niall actually very recently mentioned the Fenian movement and the you know the idea the IRB was a core... for the kind of the later Republican movement during the War of Independence, and that is very much the case from, let's say, 1917. And basically, it's quite interesting you mentioned the 1916 Rising. There's a significant cohort of ardent Republicans who don't go to Dublin for the 1916 Rising because word doesn't reach them from the IRB centre, who goes by the name of Mulholland. And kind of much like Cork, there is this kind of resentment then among the younger generation that they didn't have their opportunity to fight. So you kind of have a revitalization of this kind of young Republican vanguard, so to speak, of the Republican movement after 1916 that really want to get involved in the revolution. So a group of IRA volunteers, for example, come over to Ireland during the conscription crisis, during the McSweeney hunger strike as well, with a view to taking part in IRA action. But the IRB is really at the centre of things, especially from 1917. And Collins, obviously, Fergal mentioned, a former emigre as well, with very good connections in Liverpool, Manchester and Scotland through the IRB, sees Glasgow, but Scotland more broadly, as not only an IRB stronghold for the War of Independence movement, but as a Republican stronghold for the supply of weapons, explosives and arms specifically, much less so as a site of actual conflict itself. And this becomes one of his key conduits for making war and revolution possible in Ireland.
Where did they get the stuff? It's not of interest. I mean,
yes.
They didn't buy it, obviously. I mean, fell off the back of a lorry. I mean, how did they get it and how did they get away with
all of the above and then some? So mentioning Red Clydeside, there's obviously kind of, you know, revolution is in the air. George's Square becomes a site of transgressive activity. So there is this kind of sense of socialists, returning soldiers, mixing and you know, sharing in this kind of anti-authority movement, whatever for whatever aim. But also kind of they raided barracks, or they had the support of, you know, there was maybe an open door, so to speak. So Maryhill Barracks, places like that. Collins, very importantly, has a former sailor on the ground by the name of Joe Vyse, who is his kind of IRB contact, and he has a lot of contacts in Leith and develops a lot of relationships with former British soldiers. So there's a kind of steady stream to the point where Collins is sending upwards of £500 a week of organisation money, as he puts it. And quite interestingly, and I'll just finish at this point, It's the Scotland issue and funding of buying arms that becomes the divisive issue between Michael Collins and Cathal Brua in the War of Independence, because Collins is using his IRB money or organisation money to buy arms in Scotland and basically marginalising the structures of IRA GHQ, and that causes the tension from late 1920 and ultimately the Civil War.
Just the point of buying them.
I mean, they did just buy them in some cases from demobilised soldiers. So they just went to their houses, said, "Can I have your gun? I'll give you this." And there was a price guide sent over from Dublin by Michael Collins. They knew what to pay. So, for example, in Motherwell, there's a man called James Byrne, got 100 rifles and hundreds of handguns by just approaching ex-soldiers. Other times they raided barracks very easily. And actually in Hamilton, this town on the outskirts of Glasgow, one of the sergeants in the barracks was a veteran of the 1916 rising. So he obviously let them in and they took what they wanted.
How much arms manufacturing went on in Scotland, by the way?
Yeah, there was big munitions factories.
So it's a central production. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fergal, you want to come in?
If you look at the military service pensions collection that released something called the IRA nominal rolls, which is full of all sorts of fascinating information, but
just explain what the military service pensions are.
The Irish government, Fianna Fáil, coming from the anti-treaty background, passed legislation to basically give pensions to people who'd fought during the revolution in the IRA, and this meant that anti-treatyites and much larger numbers of IRA people could now qualify for pensions. So in the end, they ended up getting applications from about 80,000 people, not just from Ireland, but across the world by that point. So one of the things they had to do was figure out actually who was in the IRA 1919-21, so they could figure out who actually deserves some compensation. So in the mid-1930s, they start generating these huge collections of records called the nominal rolls and brigade reports, and basically just masses and masses of information about names, places, officers, structures, and so on. So
and who shot who, and I mean,
detailed accounts of what they actually did. So I had a look at the Scottish Brigade's records, which you can just Google Scottish Brigade military service pensions, and you'll find it. It's a huge collection, but what's interesting about it is it's basically the Scottish IRA making the case as to why they should be compensated because their role was important. So this is what they're emphasising. So they are emphasising the fact that they sent small numbers over to Ireland to fight. That's kind of an important thing. But they're also emphasising that their role was essentially that of a kind of a support. I think Michael Collins referred to the Scottish IRA as being the auxiliaries of our attacking forces. So that was really understood by everyone, that the role was to secure arms and to keep the flow of arms going. So they did things like they gained access to collieries in mining districts to secure gelignite and detonators. They secured and safeguard dumps. They transported arms to clearinghouses. That often involved a lot of women, networks of Cumann na Mban and other women as well as men. They armed raids. They had armed raids for arms and munitions. They set up a purchasing committee with purchasing agents, as Niall was saying. So, for example, it was £4 for a rifle, £3 for an automatic, and so on. At one point, you had people coming over from different brigades in Ireland purchasing direct from
Scotland. Yeah, so it wasn't all centralised.
Well, everyone was fed up in Ireland about GHQ not distributing enough arms and not distributing the arms fairly. They bought a lot of arms and they smuggled arms. So most of the arms that come to Ireland come from Liverpool and Glasgow. So that's really important, the presence of the IRA in the docks and on the ships. But what's really interesting about the collection that I looked at is that they don't talk about fighting. I mean, there's only two kind of violent incidents which are mentioned. But so they're not making the case that their importance is anything other than this kind of logistical, strategic importance. I can say a little bit about how many there were and where they were.
Yeah, just one question on the arms, though. Have you any idea what the quantity of stuff, how much hardware did they actually manage to ship out?
Brian Hanley's been doing a lot of research on arms, and he makes the point that given how few arms there were in Ireland, any amount of arms was important. Right. But given the difficulty of actually shipping large numbers of arms, so say you got 100 rifles, when you think about the impact that makes across the whole of the country, a couple of rifles for each brigade, so that it was, on the one hand, it was important, to have some flow, but it was never really, they never really managed to use the millions of dollars that were raised, say, in America to bring in mass shipments, because it just proved too difficult to bring in anything other than small amounts. So if you look at the witness statements of people like Seamus Reader and Seamus Robinson, they're really interesting, because every time they come to Dublin or Belfast, they're bringing over 5 guns, 2 rifles, suitcases. It's all smuggled in a very kind of piecemeal kind of fashion.
I'll point in a second. And how much stuff was seized by the authorities? Any figures on that?
Figures for how many people were arrested? I think around 200 people in Scotland were arrested. Now, that wasn't all for smuggling, but a significant amount of them were arrested for possession of arms, smuggling of arms. So it was a pretty big operation. Mm. The only other thing I was going to say about in terms of numbers, you've got maybe around 2,500 people on what's called the nominal roll, so Irish volunteer members by the summer of 1921, which is very, very big. It's very big in comparison to England. But in terms of the actual people who are doing most of the key operations, the buying of weapons, the smuggling, that's a much smaller group of people who wouldn't be that larger group who would maybe do drilling and do this kind of almost like public-facing Irish volunteers. You're looking at this inner core of IRB organisers who do things in a much more kind of informal way. So it's a much smaller number of people who basically control operations. And going back to Dara's point, this was all sorts of infighting. I mean, this is basically people who owed their loyalty to Collins. Mm. And so rows between Brewer and Collins extend into rows between different officers and companies in Scotland, because the network is connected.
Dara, you want to come in there?
Just in terms of to Fergus's point about the smuggling of arms and knives as well, Collins's kind of main objective is to make this a very proficient, professional operation for when he comes in charge in 1918. And by 1920, what's happening is that the arms that are being collected in Glasgow, London, Liverpool are all being shipped and routed through Liverpool as a kind of central storing house, because British intelligence, and this is going full circle, because of Red Clydeside is so hot on the Republican movement in Scotland that they're searching houses and so on. So everything's been shipped through Liverpool. So you actually have, by late 1920, just before Bloody Sunday, basically, a quite sophisticated joined-up network of arms smuggling within the United Kingdom that goes through Liverpool primarily. But just to give you an example of the numbers, Henry Coyle, who is one of the chief smugglers in arms, was actually, they used to use the train from Glasgow to Liverpool. So you use public transport to move stuff from city to city. He decided to go in a lorry. And after the attacks on the Liverpool docks in November 1920, there were huge raids, but 20 Republicans were arrested. He went on the run and on a high-speed chase, and I use that term loosely, through Alloa, by which 300 revolvers and 2 swords were picked up by the police authorities, which gives you a sense of the kind of the randomness of it. But I just want to mention one other thing, which I think is really important, and it circles back to this issue of class and, you know, and so on. The IRB, as Collins directed in Scotland, were very much a class-based organisation in the sense of hierarchy of Irish nationalisms. And if you read the correspondence between Collins and his people on the ground in Scotland and so on, he talks about the IRB types, the IRB men being of men of the right kind recurrently, and the left-wing people who are supporting the Irish Citizen Army and secreting arms as undesirables. And this is like monthly. So there is almost, you know, this idea of that Kevin O'Higgins mentioned, the Republican movement being the most conservative revolutionaries ever to put together a successful revolution. Collins' relationship with Scotland was emblematic of that. There was certainly a status attached to the IRB, but it's also a class thing. And to be working class or to have socialist views to him was antithetical to the revolutionary movement.
Kirsty, I just want to bring it in here, because mention being made of Margaret Skinner. What were the role of women in all this like? What are they doing in this part of the world?
They were very much involved in that smuggling operation. So we sort of have that moving from 1915 onwards, carrying on past the Rising into the War of Independence. And they're using similar methods the whole way through. So people like Seamus Reader and Margaret Skinner would be visiting the shipyards and removing weapons. Women would be the lookouts, they would be the cover-up, it would be boyfriend and girlfriend out for a walk, but they would then take a much more active role in the smuggling. Often it would be the case of fuses or gaelic knight hidden in her clothes. Margaret Skinner famously had detonators in her hat and a bomb in her hat, and fuses wrapped around her body, but that wasn't the only time that happened. Looking on to 1917, 1918, we've got Catherine Rooney, who was Irish-born, had been involved in the GPO, has moved to Glasgow for work, and she's then returning to visit her family in Dublin with fuses sewed into her clothing, and this became something that was regularly done as a way of smuggling because women were less likely to be stopped. So you had Seamus Reader and Joe Robinson would be handing over gelignite on the middle of Sauchie Hall Street. At night they'd be visiting them in the grocery stores to make exchange, and it was that they were a less suspicious target, so it was easier to be used for the smuggling.
Tell you, just before I ask the next point, just to remind everybody, if you have a question, if you want to make an observation, I'm just keeping an eye on the time here. We don't want this to be like a sing-song where everybody wants to get in at the end, you know. Enda, yeah. Can we use the radio mic, Enda, just so you can be heard?
DIY.
And if you can...
Given the contribution of Scots people based in Scotland, Irish-based people in Scotland, and famously in James Connolly, that case, why do you think Ireland itself has been so reluctant to acknowledge the role that people played outside of Ireland during the Irish Revolution? There was a well-known case during the 1916 commemorations where a descendant of James Connolly is abused and told that, you know, what are you doing? You're English. What are you doing at this event? I think it was something in Dublin Castle. Why do you think Ireland has been slow to acknowledge the role of people who weren't necessarily in Ireland, whether they're Irish or otherwise?
I think in some ways it's been sort of subsumed by history. Connolly himself put in the 1911 census that he was from Monaghan. Even if you look at Scottish newspapers from 1916, he's described as being from Monaghan or Cork. Nora Connolly, who was Edinburgh-born herself, his daughter, very much bought into that sort of myth of her father being born in Monaghan. And there was this basis of, you know, Ireland's hero had to be Irish. He couldn't be from outside of that country, almost.
I think there might be a Scottish side of it we need to think about. I mean, certainly you can find lots of quotations from people like De Valera and Collins testifying to how important Scotland was, and you know, maybe you could take it with a pinch of salt because they probably go to America and say how important America was too, but there certainly is plenty of acknowledgement from revolutionaries of the time and afterwards. But I wonder if it's a case of, you know, social memory is an interesting thing. We used to think that sort of governments or states kind of constructed the narratives of revolutions and how they're remembered, but increasingly, you know, we see that memory is sort of constructed from below. Chris Bambury in his The People's History of Scotland suggested that the Scottish history, the history of sort of Irish Republicans in Scotland, was a forgotten history, and he makes the point that you're looking at a population that's quite working class, quite a lot of poverty. It's a transient population, so the material I was looking at in the 1930s, a lot of the people who were fighting with the IRA in Scotland in 1919 are actually gone. They're in America, they're back in Ireland, they're scattered other places. And also, if you think about the context in which, how are people in Scotland maybe going to tell their story about what they did and build memorials and the kind of write memoirs and so on? They're in a society, certainly in the west of Scotland, where there's a lot of sectarianism. There's a lot of reasons why there's anti-immigrant sentiment. There's a lot of reasons why it's maybe difficult for them to sort of, for that memory to sort of take hold in a way which we see differently in the south of Ireland. And maybe there's a kind of comparison. If you look at Republicans north of the border, they do much less kind of remembering, and they get much less acknowledgement because of the political context after the revolution. I think that's at least part of the story.
Can I just say, yeah, just follow up on that? I'm thinking more about in Ireland itself. I mean, I can understand the Scottish context. I grew up beside James Connolly Memorial Hospital. I didn't know James Connolly had a, you know, Scottish.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think I'd be unique like that. Lots of people don't realise that Connolly is Scottish. Hasn't really suited the sort of the narrative of the revolution coming from within the great sort of Irish soul to say that it may have come actually from other places as well, not just Ireland.
Well, the dialogue maybe suggests an explanation is just straightforward snobbery, like that people who go to, I mean, even look at the 1916 proclamation, exiled children in America. What about all the other exiled children? You know, they're only one small section of them. But this idea that the Irish Americans are the kind of creme de la creme, and then you've got these working class gutties who go to Birmingham and Glasgow and Edinburgh, and they're of an inferior quality, you know.
I think also it kind of to go beyond the island, and you've written obviously extensively, is to disrupt the expected chronologies and collective memory of especially this period, etc. So we kind of almost fall quite neatly into kind of the periodization of the Irish Revolution as the following events and the collective memory. But that's, you know, there are often, you know, invented traditions associated with that, this kind of raids and rallies approach to how we remember this. Whereas obviously, you know, I think Morris Walsh wrote about this in Bitter Freedom. He said, the Irish Revolution most experienced in the world was a non-violent propagandist one. When you think that you take the global population, and actually Ireland was an island in terms of political violence, you know, Irish political violence. So the revolution as experienced in the United States, Australia, was not the same revolution as experienced in domestically.
I think from the Scottish perspective as well, is the Scottish involvement in Ireland was, as fighting force, was minor. Connolly, maybe 30 for the Kimmage garrison, so there was a very sort of minor physical force there. It was the support that came from Scotland, was slightly different dynamic, perhaps, which could be part of that.
And I do think you're right. I think in terms of what you're getting at, in terms of as soon as the revolution is over, the Irish Free State begin constructing a narrative of the revolution that really emphasises respectability in the Irish Free State. I mean, that's the key kind of characteristic. And I guess these, you know, the attitudes to Irish emigrants generally are pretty hypocritical and lack empathy and sympathy. And I guess a lot of these working class people who left Ireland and Liverpool and Manchester, they don't fit the idea of the, you know, the notion of a ambushes at the crossroads and so on. And I mean, Brian Hanley makes this point in his work on gun running. There's a lot of interconnections with criminal gangs in places like Birmingham and so on. It's a kind of seedy, sordid stories and so on, and it doesn't fit maybe the image that the IRA, that the Free State want to project of the IRA being a very noble force fighting a very conventional kind of war. Even in fact, the kind of some of the stuff that they do, like there's very little violence in Scotland, but you know, arson and burning down of warehouses in Liverpool and so on. The ideas about maybe assassinating people, they're very difficult to sort of make part of a kind of heroic narrative of how the war was won.
Following on from that, from the idea of image and a heroic image, there is the narrative Connolly that's been told in Scotland, that if you bring in his Scottish aspect, suddenly becomes slightly problematic, and that the newspapers of the time are calling Connolly not only a traitor to his country, but his family. Spreading stories about how two of his nephews have been killed in the First World War, and they weren't, but his brother, I believe, was buried with full military honours in June 1916. So you have this sort of tale of two brothers that suddenly becomes quite problematic when you consider that Connolly was fighting against the British state, and that doesn't necessarily fit into a sort of clean-cut narrative.
Now, does anybody else want to come in? We have the mic here if you do. Just while you're gathering your thoughts, just looking at this from we've been talking about the revolutionary side or the Irish side. I mean, and what about from the point of view of the government and the powers that be, right? I mean, did they have perception of this kind of a red-green alliance, for want of a better phrase? You know, was that part of their perception of what was going on here?
The British government.
Yeah, British government and, you know, the ruling circles generally.
Yeah, I mean, Dara may want to speak to this as well, but I think you have a lot of British military and intelligence kind of figures, a lot of them with very strong connections to Ulster Unionism, so there's kind of an Ulster Unionist Orange kind of establishment which stretches into Britain. And very often what you get is a kind of suggested alliance between Bolshevism in Russia, the threatened labour strikes in places like the Clydeside and in England, the Irish question, and of course the sort of imperial crisis, the anti-imperial nationalism in India and Egypt and so on. Now, I don't think these things were as connected as the intelligence officials thought, but there's a kind of an official mindset which sees a kind of a post-war attack on the whole social and political order that's in a way much more joined up than it actually is. So there's a kind of a mentality of maybe paranoia.
That sort of paranoia, of course, can cut both ways. I mean, we've been talking about the radical element of it, but it can also drive people in the other direction. And I'm thinking here now the period of the war, you know, the War of Independence itself. I mean, there are British soldiers getting killed in Ireland, and I'm assuming a fair proportion of them were Scottish.
Yeah.
So how's that playing back in the home fires?
I think it's John McLean that writes the pamphlet, Ireland's Tragedy, Scotland's Disgrace, which is writing against the involvement of Scottish soldiers in the Irish War of Independence. He's saying that the working class and nationalist movement should be combined. At this stage, he's turned to support for Irish independence. He's sharing stage with Countess Markovitch. He's writing heavily in support of that. So he's very much against that idea of the Scottish soldiers being involved in the War of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
To
agree with Fergal, first of all, the authorities kind of, I mean, it didn't turn a blind eye to the gun running, but it wasn't policed as rigorously as you might imagine until there was a suspected maybe red connection or a socialist or communist connection. There was also a policeman killed in Scotland by the IRA during a botched prison break in 1921, and that did mobilise the police much more so against the IRA and the crackdown on them. So there was more repression following that, in also following...
But now you're saying that they're more concerned about the Red Scare than the Green Scare, if you know what I mean?
They were more concerned about Red Links, and McLean was the worst. So the police report on McLean said he's one of the worst. He's like a mix of red and green.
Right.
And this is what we're trying to avoid, trying to police.
And it's that Irish influence that's also turning him towards support for Scottish independence too.
Right.
And the idea that in a smaller nation, socialism can take... sort of more power can overturn the government.
I think distance also plays a part. There's quite a revealing series of correspondence just in terms of numbers, if I can give them to them. So the John Carney, who's the senior IRA commandant, and when he arrives in August 1920, says there were 630 IRA men, not including Cumann na mBan, in Scotland at the time. A month later, the Procurator of Fiscal in Scotland says there's 10,000. By the time the news reaches London, a month later, it's 30,000 and 20,000 with rifles. And so there is that sense of distance when you're in London, you're reporting on, because you're seeing this iconography of revolution as well in the press and so on. So actually, Scotland's probably overrepresented in the intelligence files comparatively to, let's say, London or Manchester and so on. Some with due cause, but others definitely a paranoia setting in. Yeah.
I think it's also very useful for us to think about the War of Independence as not so much a military conflict, but as a political and a propaganda conflict, primarily with the ability to prolong a kind of guerrilla war insurrection as being an important part of that. And in that case, the politics of weakening Britain's resolve in Ireland is very important. And I think one of the differences in Britain and looking at some other imperial conflicts at the same time, Britain is a relatively liberal and democratic state. And so it's very important for Irish Republicans to cultivate trade union opinion, Labour Party opinion, liberal left-wing newspapers and so on. I think there's maybe a case that Irish Republicans aren't that successful in doing it in Britain as, say, they are in America. But nonetheless, I think that's quite important in sort of the gradual pressure on David Lloyd George. Sort of, you know, it's very difficult to justify the black and tans or auxiliaries. So that presence, I suppose, of the diaspora politics trying to link in with progressive currents within Scotland is quite an important part of applying a kind of pressure on Britain. I think you could say that Irish Republicans most effectively pressure British policy in Ireland, outside Ireland, in the US, in the Empire, in places like Scotland. That's in a sense where they've got a bit more kind of leverage to sort of say, this is pretty hard to justify what you're doing.
Mm. Now, I'm just looking at the clock here. Treaty then is signed in December 1921, right? I don't jump into the Civil War here, just look at the treaty, right? How did that go down? Both amongst the British establishment, but also amongst, say, the fellow travellers, the support network, say, outside Ireland. Were they confused by it, or what? Did they welcome it?
So I think there was a sense of, to my earlier point, that the Sinn Féin movement in Scotland was probably more Republican in some cases than their movement at home. And there is always that sense, again, going back to earlier discussions about, you know, the idea of the diaspora Irish being more Irish than the Irish at home. So there's a very strong sentiment against the treaty, certainly among the Sinn Féin movement and also the IRA. They're almost unanimously anti-treaty as a movement. So the active forces are anti-treaty. But then you have a core kind of the Sinn Féin type who are kind of political. And don't forget the idea of old wine in new bottles. There's certainly an element of transfer or crossover of personnel from the old Home Rule movement from, let's say, 1920, so a bit later than Ireland, to the new Sinn Féin movement. And obviously they're much more accepting in general terms of the treaty. But so I think that's kind of it strengthens the Republican movement's resolve to act, actually, in a way. And I know you don't want to go into the treaty, the Civil War, but I'll go there briefly. Sure, I'll go there briefly. The Republican movement in Scotland becomes one of the core pillars of De Valera's anti-treaty movement after the treaty had signed and after the beginning of the Civil War. And it's one of the last kind of outposts of the Republican movement from December 21, really.
Just my point about the British establishment, right? This is the point, again, Brian Handy has made more than once. The we kind of don't appreciate the sense that they saw the treaty as a defeat or a retreat, at the very least, if not a defeat. I mean, he said that in terms of even just the acreage of territory, was more than Germany lost after the First World War.
Yeah, I mean, I'm often surprised by how little kind of awareness there is, and certainly in parts of Britain, about how crucial the events of 1920, 21, 22 were in shaping the UK itself and the UK's kind of border. I suspect, you know, we won't have a lot of attention paid to partition, for example, next year. It's certainly in parts of England. I think at the time,
not sure about that. Backstop's going to be in the headlines, I'm sure, right?
Perhaps.
Don't mention the war.
I mean,
Jesus.
The British committee, which has been doing the 1914 to 1918 commemoration, which has been very kind of successful, have come to the decision that they're going to stop commemorating and not go into the post-war period, against the advice of historians like Hugh Strawn, for example, who advises the committee. He says it's the post-war period is really important, not just a kind of part of global history, but a part of British history because of what's happening in places like Ireland and India. And it seems to me there's very little political appetite, certainly in the Tory party, in the British government, to reflect on what happens after the First World War, because violence, you know, continues on in a different form, but in a way which really shapes not just Ireland, but shapes Britain in really important ways. And I think it's a bit like, to go back to Brexit, you know, sometimes there's a tendency to just not pay attention to Ireland, to take the eye off the ball, you know.
It's surely important. Not.
But to go back to the treaty, I mean, I think diehards on both sides are... diehards on both sides are pretty defeated. So you've got anti-treaty areas, Munster, where most of the fighting is going on, and they feel betrayed is too strong, but they're really surprised that suddenly the conflict has come to an end and there's a truce, when they felt that they could push on and achieve more. As soon as you have a truce, it's obvious that there's not going to be a republic, that what will follow will be a compromise. And on the British side, you've got, I think, by and large, British... senior figures in the British Army are quite relieved that it's come to an end, that they're sick of the fighting, they think it can only be politically resolved. But you've got diehard kind of British and unionist figures who feel kind of similar. We had them on the run, we could have finished the effort. So, of course, I think any kind of compromise is going to leave the extremes unhappy.
Now, of course, in Ireland, it all was pear-shaped, the treaty split, the Civil War. So how does that, I mean, I'm thinking of poor old John McLean again, right? It's the second or third time he's in jail, and he comes out like, and Ireland is tearing itself apart with this, you know, with the Civil War. Mm. I mean, his whole position was in tatters, essentially.
I mean, I wouldn't say his position was in tatters. He actually dies in 1923, so he doesn't see the Civil War right to its end. I mean, McLean's reading of the Civil War, I'm sure, was based more on class and social factors than maybe other people in Ireland would have afforded the same reading. But in Scotland, to come back to the Civil War, I think the Scottish IRA are predominantly anti-treaty. And of course, one of the big events during the Civil War in Scotland is, and across Britain, of course, is that numerous people are deported from Britain back to the Free State at the behest of the Free State and interned in Ireland in Mountjoy. And this is actually illegal. It happens in March 1923. I think 40 Scottish IRA men, officers, are deported to Ireland, which is very damaging to the movement and activity. And they're actually released in May, because when it's challenged by Art O'Brien, it's proven that the act of deporting them from Britain to Ireland to be interned is actually illegal.
Now, Fergal, am I right in that Irish-American opinion, on the other hand, tend to be pro-treaty. Am I right in that?
There's someone in the audience I could, who perhaps
give that man a microphone
on this point. I'll put him on the spot. It's Patrick Mannion.
Patrick, by the way, just to give him a plug, he also has an article in our supplement, right? So take it away, Patrick.
Well, I won't comment too much on the post-treaty situation, but obviously in the United States, like what I study is the ancient order of Hibernians. And if you look at the AOH from even before the Easter Rising, they were far more rapidly Republican, and this reflected broader Irish and American opinion than almost anything you would see in Ireland, with the exception of some of the hardliners. And that obviously continues right through the revolutionary era. I also study Canada. I probably define myself much more as an Irish Canadian rather than an Irish American. So. And in Canada, political opinion amongst the Irish was far more moderate. It tended to be constitutional. It tended to be very much steeped in imperial loyalty. The language of home rule continued not only after the Easter Rising in 1916, but in many cases after 1919, 20, and 21. You still get Irish Canadians clinging to Ireland as being part of the British Empire, because Canada, of course, was part of the British Empire, and they had lived quite contentedly within the structures of the empire for generations in some cases. So republicanism was very slow to take hold in places like Canada, Newfoundland, and I think Australia and New Zealand, you will see that as well. Mm. So America really stands out as, I think, exceptional within the global Irish diaspora, rather than sort of being the
One of the things we didn't discuss is there's kind of particular characteristics of diaspora politics, and factionalism is one of them. Mm. And like when De Valera goes to America, he really splits Irish-American opinion quite badly into different factions. And so you have some people who you would think of as being diehard Republicans, like John Devoy, who become supporters of the Free State, I think in part because they hate De Valera. But you've obviously got a lot of radical Irish-American opinion throwed away behind De Valera and his efforts to...
It is a mixed bag then.
Oh, it's definitely a mixed bag. And if you look, there's a lot of mainstream opinion that we don't pay too much attention to, like the Catholic Church, for example. They would have been very uneasy supporting Republican violence. And then we also have a lot of Labour opinion, which we tend not to think of, So I think it's quite a complicated picture. But I think one of the main impacts of the Civil War on the diaspora is a kind of embarrassment, confusion, dismay. And the sort of the period from about 1916 to 1923, looking back on it in a lot of countries, it's a really unique moment of sort of Irish identity becoming a very important thing, because you have a sort of a mobilisation of Irish opinion globally. And in a lot of places that just fizzles out quite quickly because of the impact of the Civil War and the disappointments. And the people just, you know, if you're in Melbourne, it's just very hard to follow what's happened and to know which side to...
There's one specific event, actually, that kind of really emphasises that, and that's the Irish Race Congress, which meets in Paris in January 1922 at the behest of De Valera several months earlier. And this is supposed to be the great triumphant message from around the world that the Irish diaspora can speak politically for the Irish nation. And you have strong representation from Scotland, notwithstanding the United States and so on. But this kind of becomes a week full of recrimination, because it's the 7th to the 14th of January 1922. The treaty has just been defeated, but basically the divides of the treaty vote are now transferred to Paris. So where this grand strategy of global politics basically falls apart on the divides of the treaty. But to Fergal's point, many of the diaspora delegates, some of them travel from Peru, for example, and as far away as Australia, find it very puzzling and don't quite understand the nuances of, the divides of the treaty settlement. It's not quite the politics that they would be used to or accustomed to.
Yeah, but just, sorry, Chris, you want to come in there, yeah?
Yeah, I was just following on from what Fergal was saying, thinking we still sort of feel the influence of that time period in Scotland and sort of contemporary debate about Scottish politics. It was something that was very odd about the nature of the Scottish independence referendum. The run-up to it was the absence of Ireland and the absence of conversations about Ireland or references to it. It was very much done on a sort of vague economic term initially. It was references to Parnell, but that time period remains very absent from discussions. And I don't know if there's a certain element.
Might have been sensible.
It does say a different thing. But yeah, any mentions of Ireland, I think, because of that time period, become very much silenced in part of the political debate there.
Just I'm looking at the time here, guys. So we're nearly coming to the end here. So if now is your chance, if you want to make a contribution or ask a question. I just want to make it, just going back to the global theme here, because it seems to me, Irish people have beaten themselves up for years about the bitter divisions and disaster of the Civil War, right? But if you take the broader global view, that type of reaction or pullback from revolution is happening all over the globe. In other words, Ireland is not exceptional. It's part of a general pattern.
Being followed by
that the revolutionary movements reach a certain peak and then they recede. And we're just the same.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting to look at it comparatively. So Ireland is one of a big group of nations who in the immediate aftermath of the First World War want independence. Now, those nations which fall within Central and Eastern Europe and want independence from a defeated empire, that's no problem. Those nations who want to get independence from a victorious empire, they're generally not successful. So Ireland, in some ways, compares to countries like India and Egypt. If you look at the international press, they're grouped together most often. And I think there's a case to be made that Ireland is more successful for a variety of reasons, partly because there is a very, very effective campaign at home and mobilising a kind of international, global kind of diaspora and audience. But I think also Ireland is treated differently to India or Egypt. I mean, you look at the levels of violence that Britain uses in Ireland and in India at the same time. So, for example, when Bloody Sunday happens, it's described as Ireland's Amritsar. But, I think it's 14 people killed instead of 600 or so.
Yeah.
And also the way in which, and this is something our project is looking, the way in which rhetoric about race is used is quite interesting. So Irish Republicans can say, well, all the other Irish nations have won their freedom. We're the last white people still enslaved. So I think it's really useful to sort of to take that kind of comparative global frame and look at relatively what Ireland achieved. And if you do that, you can see that Ireland, a lot of people in other parts of the world would say getting the treaty, the British handing over Dublin Castle, the army leaving, was a very, very surprising and a very impressive kind of achievement. But of course, because of our treaty split and civil war, it wasn't seen that way at home. But I think it was certainly how many other people saw it. This showed that small countries could take on much more powerful empires effectively.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering how far you think there was a kind of genuine interest and commitment to internationalism and interest in like global movements among Irish Republicans, or is it mainly that they're just using it strategically, like to get money or arms?
That's a good question. Is it totally unprincipled and pragmatic, or did they really believe the rhetoric?
It's a really good question. I think there's a sense of a global moment around this time, which certainly dissipates very quickly after the Civil War, to the point where you can talk about a conservative revolution and counter-revolution happening. People like Liam Mellows, for example, writes very often about socialism around the world, and there is that sense of continuity. If you go to the States, and Fergal alluded to this, that even Irish Americans, not only rhetorically, but the famous image of course of De Valera in Native American headdress, but he actually is meeting African Americans, Native Americans, and others as well. So there's that sense of kind of anti-authority, kind of a collectivity. And someone has made this point previously, so I'm not claiming any credit for this, saying that the executions, especially, which of course the Civil War has become renowned for, infamously, of Liam Mellows and others, was perhaps not only the death of those individuals, but the death of ideas, among them internationalism. So that could be something we look at.
No, it's an interesting point you make, because, the classic case is the Democratic Programme, right? Democratic Programme was passed unanimously by the Dáil whenever, in January, right? And I have to say, this is just a purely personal thing, I'm always very suspicious of anything that's passed unanimously, right? I'm always much happier if there's a really knockdown kick, nasty fight, and then there's a very tight vote, and then people vote for something, and you'll find that it's far more purchase-like. But anyway, that's just an observation. Because it seems to me that the Democratic Programme was passed just to impress the International Labour Organization. Well, that's just one way of looking at it. In other words, like that they really just want to get this passed so they could go to the the ILO in Geneva and say, you know, we want your support. Mm-hmm. You know?
I think also to go back to Dara's point and partly to answer the question, I mean, I think, of course, there is solidarity, but some Republicans are much more progressive than others. But I think what there is in 1919 across many different countries is there's this realisation that the rules of the game have changed, that, you know, particularly because of the Wilsonian idea being so popular, that the nation state has become legitimised, and that if you can frame your political conflict in terms of the demand for democratic national self-determination against imperialism, that in a sense helps slightly to so you find groups of anti-imperialists who I think have very little connection between each other using the same kind of language and arguments, and they're kind of grafting that onto their own longer kind of national struggles. And I think in some ways that's really the key thing for us to understand how, you know, just like we might think about the Arab Spring, there are these moments when suddenly doors that seemed closed before the First World War kind of opened up, and you can make arguments which are very almost in parallel but aren't necessarily dependent on a kind of a close contact or a shared kind of conspiracy or subversion between different national groupings. And of course there are occasions when they're all in the same places, like they're in New York or they're outside Paris during the Versailles Conference and so on. So there are also some connections, but I'm not sure that they are that important compared to the sense that the way in which political power operates is understood to have changed.
Maybe,
yeah.
Just to say very briefly on that, just different types of internationalism, and maybe one of the most sort of vibrant spaces of internationalism was campaigns for political prisoners, and of course there was lots of them on the Irish nationalist side. But if you think of Hannah Sheehy Skeffington when she goes to the United States, on the question of political prisoners, there is solidarity. There's a lot of kind of cohesiveness between groups and political prisoners' campaigns that maybe you wouldn't get otherwise in terms of political approaches.
Yeah, because I think very much what you've got there is after 1916, it's the women that really have to carry on the sort of argument who are going over to America. They're taking the speaking tours, and it's actually two Scots, Nora Connolly and Margaret Skinner, who are publishing in America in that time period to raise support for Irish independence. I think Do My Bit for Ireland was published in 1917, Unbroken Tradition was published in 1918, and they very much focused on the sort of personal aspects, the loss of a father, the injury of a young woman, to sort of draw that support on a very personal level from those they were speaking to, and that's combined with Hannah Sheehy Skeffington, who's organising these lecture tours.
Now, anybody else? If there isn't, I will wrap up. Just a final question here. We've touched on it before. I mean, how this whole Scottish angle, I mean, somebody made the point that they didn't hear much about the fact that Connolly was Scottish. I mean, do you think it has been airbrushed out?
Yes. I spent the year before I started studying Irish Scottish studies in Dublin, and people say, "Oh, Irish Scottish connections. Are there any for 1916? You go, "Oh, well, Connolly."
Mm.
And you get a blank look in respect. Mm. I think that was very much part of Connolly's own sort of creation of his own myth, and seeing that he was from Monaghan, very much in the way Nora Connolly struggled with the idea of Edinburgh birth. And you see even her own writings through. She moves from being Northern to Scottish in the end, and sort of comes to a greater acceptance of it. But yeah, I think Connolly Scottishness especially has been sort of airbrushed out of history.
Yeah. Well, I just wanted to as we're nearing the end, to sort of end with a slightly positive point, which is if the revolutionary contribution of Irish people in Scotland was forgotten, we now have an opportunity to write it, because the material that's coming out of the military service pensions collection, so not just this huge amount of information about the Scottish Brigade, but also we can track through individual military pension applications, we can track what happened to vast numbers of Irish people in Scotland, in other countries, and we can reconstruct not just what their revolutionary role was, including the role of women, which increasingly we have more information, but we can also kind of ask what happened to them afterwards. Where did they go? Where did they end up? And so there's a very rich, we have the opportunity for the first time, I think, to write a really kind of rich history of this very important kind of phenomena of aspect of the revolution. But I think it's important, it's not just in terms of their role in the revolution, but actually it could ask really interesting questions about
the identity of Irish people in Scotland, about ethnicity, about political, you know, there's so much more that we can do with this material. So I think we will see a lot more in the future, because we now have the sort of the raw material we need to do it.
And we also have the History of Ireland special supplement, A Global History of the Irish Revolution, which will educate the whole country, I'm sure. Word is it's selling well, Fargal, and you'll be glad to hear. Listen, I'm going to have to wrap up here, guys. We've had a very interesting discussion. I've learned a few things myself, for sure. So I'd like to thank our speakers, Dara Gannon and Fergal McGarry, Niall Whelehan and Kirsty Lusk. I'd like to thank you, the audience, in particular those of you who made a contribution on the floor. And I hope you'll be back at the next Hedge School. The next Hedge School, by the way, is not till the end of August. It's at the Electric Picnic Rock Festival. So if you want, it always rains, but that's okay, because that means you can come into the tent to the Hedge School. So if you want to don the wellies and come over to that, I might see you there. So thank you very much. Thank you. This is still on the
What's your topic or theme for the electric?
I've only one of them. It's the emergency.
Oh, right.
It's the.
Okay, it happens, but I think it went pretty well.
Anniversary, is it?
I mean, I kind of wanted to end in a negative.
39, yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm a Rangers supporter.
No, I have. Fairly delighted this. My star is my star panelist is David McCullough.
He's a Celtic supporter,
How are you doing? Harry Cormack. Harry Cormack, how are you? Oh, yes, yes, yes. Sorry, you're saying Cormack. Oh, yes, yes. What was the article about?
I was at an event.
I'll be in touch.
Hello, brilliant.
I was trusting you to keep us on time.
What's that?
It's like, what was the presidential election where the presidential candidate looked at his watch? Was it Bush against Clinton in the debate? We didn't win, and they reckon.